This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, March 29, 2007. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado. Human rights advocates protest torture while a House committee considers the future of the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. Sri Lanka's government offers Tamil Tiger rebels peace talks after the first ever rebel airstrike creates a new dimension in the decades-long civil war. And workers from various sectors in Greece continue a second day of strikes for improved wages and working conditions. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Heavy fighting has erupted on the streets of Mogadishu as Ethiopian troops carry out what they say is a three-day operation to secure the Somali capital. Ethiopian helicopters bombed a Mogadishu market today, and tanks have reportedly fired mortars in various parts of the rest of the city. Insurgents have responded with automatic rifle fire and rocket-propelled grenades. Civilians have been left stranded in different points of the city, and dozens have been hospitalized. The situation in Mogadishu has been deteriorating by the week, and tens of thousands have fled the city since the beginning of February. The Anglo-Dutch oil company Shell and three other oil firms have been charged in Nigerian court with violating the nation's nuclear safety and radiation laws. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
The Nigerian government early this week filed 27 charges against the four companies and 21 of their officials, including Shell's managing director in Nigeria. The companies and oil workers are accused of transporting radioactive materials around the Niger Delta illegally. Some of the radioactive materials were lost in transit, a situation that has generated concern for the Nigerian government and environmentalists. Apart from the environmental impact that can result from the unsafe handling of radioactive waste, there are fears the dangerous material could fall into the hands of terrorists. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Mexican President Felipe Calderon and Oaxaca's Governor Ulises Ruiz today inaugurated a controversial wind farm in the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, where multinational corporations are promoting a large energy project on what, until very recently, was indigenous farmland. Vladimir Flores reports.
The local population had very little say in the matter, and many families were forced off their land to make way for the private wind farms. The land grabs have been coupled with an intense campaign to crush opposition to a regional trade and infrastructure megaproject, as this member of the Front in Defense of the Towns of the Isthmus of Tehuantepec explains.
Thousands of campesinos in the Isthmus of Tehuantepec have been tricked into selling or handing over their lands for the construction of a project known as the Eolic Corridor, which is a part of Plan Puebla, Panama. We have been the subjects of death threats, attacks, and intimidation.
A large police and military operation was put into effect in the region to dampen protests organized by campesinos and activists who say the wind farm and the larger Plan Puebla-Panama mega project is a land grab from local indigenous communities to benefit transnational corporations and international financial institutions. For FSRN, I am Vladimir Flores in Oaxaca.
Today, a Houston-based energy company took on the construction of eight new coal-fired power plants. The move makes Dynegy the new king of coal and the target of environmentalists and investors. From Houston, Renee Feltz reports.
I don't like the coal technology that they're planning. I don't think it's a responsible thing to be doing.
Shareholder Bridget Lois Jensen opposed Dynegy's merger with LS Power, which adds plans for eight new coal-fired power plants to its energy portfolio. Financial critics say Dynegy has yet to tell shareholders how it will deal with aggressive federal regulation on climate change that could increase emission costs and delay plant construction. Analyst Eric Kane with Wall Street research firm Innovest says Dynegy's management team failed to consider what he calls carbon risks. The National Environmental Trust used a similar argument when they recently convinced energy giant TXU to halt eight of 11 new coal plants planned for Texas. In Houston, I'm Renee Felt for Free Speech Radio News.
A former Justice Department staffer told a Senate panel today that Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez has not been completely honest when speaking about the controversial dismissals of U.S. attorneys. Yin Meshe reports from Capitol Hill.
Kyle Sampson served as the Attorney General's Chief of Staff until his recent resignation. The Department of Justice portrayed Sampson as the chief engineer behind the firing of 8 prosecutors. Attorney General Gonzalez said in a press conference 2 weeks ago that he was not involved in discussions regarding the dismissals. But Sampson says the statement wasn't entirely true.
We did discuss it when he was the attorney general designate in January of 2005, I think. And then from time to time, as the process was sort of in a thinking phase through 2005 and 2006, and then I remember discussing it with him as the process sort of came to a conclusion in the fall of 2006.
Sampson's testimony could further erode support for Gonzalez in Congress. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Mingxie on Capitol Hill.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The Senate has ignored President Bush's veto threat and approved the $122 billion spending bill with a timeline for troop withdrawal. The bill, which will continue to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, orders Bush to start withdrawing troops from Iraq 120 days after its passage and sets a non-binding target date for troop withdrawal by the end of March 2008. Senator Barack Obama announced the Senate's mostly party-line vote.
The ayes are 51, the nays are 47.
President Bush, who met with House Republicans today to boost his position for a war spending bill that does not call for troop withdrawal, says he doesn't want Congress to micromanage the war.
We stand united and saying loud and clear that when we've got a troop in harm's way, we expect that troop to be fully funded.
The House version of the bill contains a binding call to withdraw troops from Iraq by August of 2008. Both bills will need to be reconciled in a House-Senate conference before it goes to the president. Bush continues to threaten a veto. Human rights advocates protested against torture outside the Rayburn Congressional Building, while the House Armed Services Committee heard arguments today in favor and against closing the detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and rolling back the Military Commissions Act. FSRN's Nan McCurdy reports from the Capitol.
Human rights activists from 6 different organizations held vigil outside the House building today during hearings on closing Guantanamo and on rescinding the Military Commissions Act. Linda Gastaitis is vice president of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture.
Well, we're protesting the Military Commissions Act, which is a law that basically allows the United States to torture detainees and keep secret prisons. And it exonerated everybody who's tortured anybody on behalf of the United States since 9/11. And we are urging Congress to roll back the MCA and to restore the basic constitutional principles and standards of fairness and morality that the United States was founded on.
Legislation has been introduced this year in the House and the Senate to roll back the controversial Military Commissions Act passed last year, as well as to close down the detention center at Guantanamo. One celebrity witness at the Armed Services hearing was Neil Katyal, the Georgetown University law professor, who won a victory last June when the Supreme Court decided in Hamdan v. Rumsfeld that the first military commission set up by the Bush administration to try detainees at Guantanamo Bay violated 4 Geneva Conventions and the Unified Code of Military Justice. Katyal says that Congress should repeal the Military Commissions Act because it's unconstitutional on so many counts that it will be struck down by the Supreme Court. And once struck down, any trials held under MCA would have to be retried. He recommends the use of courts martial.
First, the reported views of Secretaries Gates and Rice that the commission trials be moved to the United States are a crucial first step. Perhaps more important than repealing the MCA's habeas text. Trials are gripping, dramatic, and easy to follow. They are unlike detention, which involve little drama and no grand moment of resolution. The trials at Guantanamo will be watched by the world, and we cannot forget that in them, our nation, and not simply the detainees, face judgment.
In all past military commissions in U.S. history, foreigners and United States citizens were brought before them equally. Katyal says that the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution gives all persons, not just all citizens, constitutional rights.
When you think about the MCA, think about that. For the first time, this body, set up a trial system that applies only to the 5 billion people around the world outside the United States and the 12 million green card holders. A United States citizen gets the Cadillac version of justice, the foreigner gets the beat-up Chevy version, a stripped-down Guantanamo trial.
The rollback of the act would restore habeas corpus for any individual held in U.S. custody. It would prohibit the use of evidence in court gained through torture and would restore protections of the Geneva Convention. Elisa Massimino, director of the Washington Office of Human Rights First, says the U.S. policy of detention, interrogation, and trial of terror suspects at Guantanamo has been a failure, and she called on Congress to close it down.
The decision to hold detainees at Guantanamo in the first place was driven, at least in part, by a desire on the part of the administration to insulate U.S. actions taken there, detention, interrogation, and trials, from judicial scrutiny and even from the realm of law itself. Early on, one administration official, you might recall, called Guantanamo the legal equivalent of outer space. That goal, to create a law-free zone in which certain people are considered beneath the law, was illegitimate and unworthy of this nation.
Chair of the House Armed Services Committee, Missouri Democrat Ike Skelton.
Should Guantanamo facility be shut down, what do you do with the detainees, Mr. Taft?
My guess is that the facilities that are available in the United States could easily accommodate whatever number of detainees remain in Guantanamo.
That was William H. Taft, former legal advisor at the Department of State under the current administration and former acting Secretary of Defense under the Reagan administration. Similar hearings in the Senate are scheduled for April. Human rights groups are urging both the House and the Senate Armed Services Committees to attach this legislation to the Department of Defense authorization bill, because that is a must-pass bill. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nan McCurdy.
In Sri Lanka, Tamil Tiger rebels have yet to respond to a peace talk offer by the country's government as violence continues. This week's first ever rebel air raid on a highly secured Air Force base has provoked a security crisis in Sri Lanka. The sudden emergence of rebel air power has opened a new dimension in the country's decades-long civil war that has claimed the lives of nearly 70,000 people. FSRN's Pania Manikavasagam has more.
Rebels claim 40% of Sri Lanka's Air Force capability was damaged by their attack on the Katunayake base, just next to Sri Lanka's only international airport. Military officials deny this. They say 3 airmen were killed and another 15 were wounded in the attack. Army spokesman Brigadier Prasad Samarasinghe says outsiders, including the press, were not allowed to view the scene of the attack for security reasons.
This is the first time it has happened, and security forces will be vigilant hereafter. There will be a lot of measures adopted by the air force as well as the security forces to stop these things. Small aircraft came and just dropped 3 bombs and gone. Luckily, nothing has happened to the aircraft, but it's a threat to other countries.
In 2001, 20 combatants died and more than a dozen fighter aircraft and 6 civilian planes were damaged in a ground attack. Indian analyst B. Raman says the APA of the Tamil Tiger rebels poses a serious threat to the Sri Lankan government. He suggests it also poses a medium and long-term threat to neighboring India. But the Indian Foreign Secretary Shiv Sangha Menon said India is concerned by the general escalation of violence, in which the airstrike was merely one incident. He insisted the real issue is a solution to the protracted conflict. Director of Sri Lanka's National Peace Council, Dr. Jehan Pereira, sees the rebel attack on Katunayake Air Base as part of a pattern of escalation that has been in evidence for the past year.
The government strategy has been to respond to any LTT attack with greater ferocity. So it does not look as if the attack is going to lead to any change of government strategy in the short term. So I don't see any improvement in the situation. I only see a further escalation of the conflict, which is of course very dangerous and also very costly, because the people are going to suffer now. Up to now, about 300,000 people in the north and east have been displaced as a result of the fighting.
According to military officials, 27 people were killed and another 46 were wounded in clashes between the rebels and the troops during the past 3 days, bringing total casualties in intensified fighting this year to 300. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiah Manikavasagam in Vahuniya, Sri Lanka.
Australia's government revived its controversial offshore processing policy with its decision to send 82 Sri Lankan asylum seekers to a purpose-built detention center on the neighboring Pacific island nation of Nauru. While the government maintains that this tough stance is necessary to deter people smugglers, refugee advocates warn the process grossly prejudices the group's chances of a fair hearing. Erica Voles reports from Sydney.
The Australian government says unknown numbers of people die every year in the process of being smuggled out of their countries in airless containers and on leaky boats. Immigration Minister Kevin Andrews says sending asylum seekers to Nauru will help prevent this.
They will be processed according to the United Nations protocols on Nauru, but this sends a message to people in Indonesia or elsewhere that the prospect of coming to Australia and getting to Australia by this method is not one which is going to be accepted.
But Ian Rintoul from the Refugee Action Coalition says asylum seekers should not be deterred.
It is a dangerous endeavour, there's no doubt about that, but people don't flee countries like Sri Lanka or Iraq or whatever, lightly. And the fact that they are prepared to take such huge risks indicates the fear that they have of the country from which they're fleeing.
The offshore processing system, also known as the Pacific Solution, has come under fire in the past because it severely limits asylum seekers' access to legal advice. And if an asylum seeker's claim is rejected, they have no avenues of appeal. The Immigration Minister this month attempted to allay concerns by stating that the International Organisation for Migration, or IOM, would be processing the asylum seekers' applications under the auspices of the UN. But he was later forced to admit he had got it wrong. The IOM is not a part of the United Nations. In fact, it doesn't usually process refugee applications at all. Refugee advocate and migration agent Marion Lay says that the IOM is an international NGO that works to provide transport options for asylum seekers whose applications are approved.
They're not an arm of the UN at all. In fact, the UN has spoken out very clearly and strongly against this move to place people back on Nauru again for processing. And if they stick to it, they've said very clearly they will not be part at all of a process that they consider to be unlawful in international legal terms.
This means that the Australian government will in fact be processing the applications itself, as it has in the past. But according to John Gibson, an Australian attorney who specialises in refugee law, many of the 82 Sri Lankans have not received legal advice, despite government promises that they would.
They should be facilitating proper legal advice and assistance so people can frame their cases. And remember, they are coming from a fairly diabolical situation in Sri Lanka, and prima facie, the claims that they're making are very strong. You know, they're young people, they're from Tamils, they're from the north and the east. There seem to be cases of past persecution, observing human rights abuses or being subject to them, and possibility of forced recruitment by the various warring parties.
Migration agent Marion Lay remains concerned that without legal assistance, genuine refugees may see their applications overlooked on Nauru.
You know, it's not so much the processing, but the secrecy which surrounds the processing that's the problem. And what I found last time on Nauru was that people hadn't been really fairly dealt with. There were large numbers of mistakes. People's identities had been confused one with another, and people had been basically dealt with in a way that I think defied belief, given the level of ignorance among some of the people processing them.
A lack of proper scrutiny of the Sri Lankans' applications could very well lead to genuine refugees being sent home to persecution, leaving Australia in breach of its obligations under the UN Refugee Convention. This is Erica Voles in Sydney, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
As the humanitarian crisis in Darfur continues to take lives and displace thousands of innocent Sudanese, the Arab summit in Riyadh unanimously supported President Omar Bashir's utter rejection of deploying UN forces in the desert region, but tried to ease a potential conflict with the world community and the United Nations. FSRN's Ola Farawati reports.
On the sidelines of the summit, UN Chief Ban Ki-moon met with the Sudanese president for more than 3 hours in late-night talks joined by Saudi King Abdullah and Arab League Chief Amr Musa. The UN chief said the meeting was a breakthrough, while officials in Khartoum signed an agreement with the UN in which Sudan promised to take fast-track measures to give better access to aid groups, including speeding up visas for humanitarian workers. In November 2006, the UN Secretary-General convened a major diplomatic meeting at which Sudan accepted for the first time the principle of UN troops going into Darfur. However, significant disagreements remain over the size and shape of a hybrid UN-African Union force. In a speech earlier in the day at the Arab summit, al-Bashir underlined his objections to a 20,000-strong combined UN-African Union peacekeeping force, saying the United Nations should only provide financial and technical help to African peacekeepers already on the ground. Al-Bashir.
This is a violation for Sudan's sovereignty that would provoke the conflict in Darfur instead of finding a solution for it.
But some 7,000 African Union peacekeepers have not been able to put an end to the violence in Darfur, where government forces and ethnic African rebels have been battling for nearly 4 years. Al-Bashir's government is accused of backing Arab Janjaweed militiamen, blamed for widespread atrocities against ethnic African civilians. The support of the Arab League to al-Bashir angered main rebel group, the Justice and Equality Movement, representatives, who said Arabs have again submitted to the media propaganda of the Sudanese government. Haroon Abdelhamid of the Justice and Equality Movement.
If the Sudanese government continues ignoring the legitimate requests of the people of Sudan and allows the deployment of international troops, the Sudanese people will pay the price.
Jordanian political analyst Mohammed Abu Rumman said Egypt and Saudi Arabia are worried that an international intervention might mean the deployment of foreign forces near their borders, threatening their sovereignty. That, according to Abu Rumman, explains the unprecedented Arab support for the AU forces. But he added that the UN should take a stiffer position against the Arab rejection of international forces. However, the Arab leaders were all supportive. The final resolution of the two-day summit said it supports Sudan's sovereignty and will work to support any decision taken by its leadership, Arab League Secretary General Amr Musa.
We call on activating Arab unity and discussing our issues within the framework on a unified Arab stance. And we also call for activating unified Arab security mechanisms according to our Arab beliefs.
Arab analysts agree that if Arab nations are to support the Sudanese government with its rejection of an international force, they should provide it with support that helps it fairly solve the crisis, which the UN called the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech, Radio News.
The International Christian Relief Agency, World Vision, has released a report stating that half of the children living in refugee and internally displaced people's camps in Africa's Great Lakes region have been sexually abused. Entitled Their Future in Our Hands, the report suggests that the biggest threat to children in the conflict zones around the Great Lakes is not inadequate medical care, malnutrition, or military conscription, but sexual abuse. FSRN's Emmanuel Okella reports from Kampala, Uganda.
A survey of 304 children in camps in the Great Lakes region has found that one in two has experienced sexual abuse. World Vision Regional Coordinator for Research, Vat Kamasko, said boys and girls alike told researchers stories of being sexually molested by their teachers, relatives, neighbors, medical workers, and even police officers.
We administered a structured questionnaire on child sexual abuse to 304 children. The findings revealed that at least one out of every two children has been a victim of child sexual abuse. The child sexual abuse is facilitated by conditions of abject poverty, lack of protection, law and order, and negative cultural practices that go from bad to worse during displacement. The most common forms of child sexual abuse that were identified were touching breasts, buttocks and sexual parts, kissing, sex to meet basic needs.
Sheila, not her real name, lives at Pagak IDP camp in northern Uganda. In April last year, she was raped by Constable Omara John, a policeman stationed at the camp.
We were playing with my friends when he came and called me. He asked where my father has gone, and I said, he is drinking at the bar. He asked, where is mommy? I said, mommy has gone to bring food at World Food. He took me to the house and said he wanted to arrest daddy because he refused to pay his money. He said he will not arrest daddy if I accept to have sex with him. I said no, and he threw me to the mat and started removing my clothes. I started to cry, but he closed my mouth. And after, he said he will use a gun to shoot me if I talk what has happened. When mommy returned, I was crying and also bleeding. She understood that a man has raped me. I tell her the police will shoot us if we talk, but she went and brought daddy, and we went to police, and he was arrested.
Sheila was 13 at the time. Her family was displaced from Awere in the northern Uganda district of Amoro. They were displaced way back in 1999 at the height of LRA rebel brutality on the civilian populations. Constable John was charged and sentenced to 6 years in jail. Sheila has since undergone both psychological and medical treatment.
I'm now okay, but not very fine, because all my friends at school are all the time laughing at me.
Yet Sheila can be considered one of the lucky ones. Her assailant faced justice. There are hundreds of thousands more like her in camps that were surveyed across Uganda, Burundi, Tanzania, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, whose plight continues unnoticed. The World Vision Report says the boys are usually forced into sexual encounters with teachers, neighbors, and relatives who lure them with money and related goodies. A community liaison officer at Gulu Central Police Station, Jackson Bongomin, told me many parents whose children have been abused fear that if they report it, their children will become outcasts, that men in the community will not marry their daughters, while the sons will lose respect and symbol of manhood in society. Bitter poverty leads others to secretly negotiate settlements in form of money and food. World Vision researcher Vat Kamasiko says children themselves are under extreme pressure.
The children are compelled to have sex in exchange of dresses, of lotion, of food for their families, and of health care. It is forced sex, or what you may call rape.
Conflict in Africa's Great Lakes region has left about 3 million of children displaced and deprived of basic needs like food, shelter, and education. This report offers a glimpse into the suffering of a vulnerable group of children in Africa. It recommends the setting up of committees that will be specifically responsible for children's welfare at the camps. These committees would also educate children on their rights as well as watch for sexual predators. Governments in the Great Lakes region will need to create effective policies to protect internally displaced people, but most importantly, promote peaceful coexistence and good governance to prevent the conflicts that cause people to flee in the first place. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okela, reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Tyna Gisi and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Antonio Ortiz and Eric Klein. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Abogado.